Hey, y'all. This is Catherine Spires. This is Smart Mouth. We're doing another rerun episode, and I love this one because the guest, Deep Tran, knows all about Victorian-era culture. It's such an interesting conversation. She's so awesome to talk to. You guys are going to love it. And also, I mentioned last week that I had started a podcast network. No big deal. No big whoop. And though we haven't done a sort of like official press release or anything, we have started a Patreon, of course, and we've even gotten some contributors on that Patreon, and that is at patreon.com/tablecakes. And I wanted to send out a general thank you to everybody who's contributed, and we definitely want more contributors if anyone is so inclined. This week, I am going to shout out specifically Mary Dietrich. She contributed at the $10 a month level, so she gets a show. Thank you. Thank you, Mary. All right, on to the episode. Good morning, evening, afternoon, whatever time of day you listen to Smart Mouth. I'm your host, Catherine Spires, and we're back for another week of talking to our favorite people about sometimes their favorite food, although this week's episode is going to take a bit of a journey, a detour from the norm. Our guest this week is Deep Tran. She's the owner and chef at Good Girl Dinette. Is that correct?
Yes. Good Girl Dinette owns me. Shackled.
Do you find any joy in being shackled to your restaurant?
I think it's, obviously, or else okay. I would just tap out, you know, like I'm done. it's a call. I mean, you know, it's a calling when you're compelled to go, even though you're just bone tired.
Right. You know, yeah. Right. I mean, there's something kind of beautiful about that, about having a calling. Mm-hmm.
My fatigue is magnificent.
Really?
Good Girl Dinette is over 8 years old now.
Okay.
You know, so it's just, it's not like one thing. I think it's just the cumulative, like, you know, one thing can just like, one like setback would just like conjure up eight plus years of like setbacks, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just like it's like interest, you know, like it compounds. It's not
right.
Just that thing that
right.
You know, it accrues through the years. So yeah, I think I'm ready for a vacation real soon.
Like a long-term vacation?
Yeah. Like I usually what I'll do is if I have to do like speak somewhere, I'll like, hey guys, I'm going to be out, and I'll like take an extra day or two, you know.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but I haven't really done like a proper.
Where would you go? Anywhere. No speaking engagement.
You know, I want to go someplace cold. I'm not meant for anything past 75 degrees.
And you live on the east side of Los Angeles, and you work in a kitchen, and you do a lot of baking.
I do, yeah. So that's why I need a vacation from the heat.
This is making sense now.
I would like to, like, you know, Maine sounds great.
Uh-huh.
You know, like with a lot of trees. I'm not sure I can handle the humidity, but
maybe Colorado or something.
You know, that was the first state I lived in.
Oh, really?
In Colorado. Yeah. But it's, yeah.
How old were you when you were living in Colorado?
Yeah, I just stayed for like maybe like half a year, if even that long.
How old were you?
Like 5, 6.
So do you have like the barest of memories?
It's like your first time anywhere. It kind of, it sears in your memory.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, we lived in Aurora, Colorado, which is now infamous for the shootings.
That's
so
right, yeah.
But yeah, I had fond memories of it, but we definitely liked California more.
Okay.
You know, like the community was pretty sparse, so.
The community.
yeah. But, you know, like I loved the snow, though it was really kind of crazy. But,
I bet.
Yeah. Like just like the door being like. It couldn't be being blocked because of snow, and I was like, "What the hell?" Like or snow day, you know.
That
was
the concept of a snow day,
yeah.
In and of itself.
Yeah. So,
aw, that's kind of cute.
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually would love to go to like Portland, just somewhere cool and lush, and mm-hmm. You know.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to Seattle next week, not to rub it in, but
rub it in. I definitely live vicariously through other people's.
Well, because you're working long days, but you're a chef, but you have speaking engagements. So tell us how that sort of thing came about.
It doesn't happen very often. It's more, if I'm asked to, the speaking engagements are usually about labor, valuing the labor that runs, that fuels the restaurant industry more. So that stuff, I'm very dedicated to. So that's kind of the only time I really go out. And
I mean, because you've done some pretty public work in defense of all things restaurant life, all things restaurant industry. You wrote a great piece for NPR about pricing and expectations when people go out to different kinds of restaurants. And that's also interesting. What inspired you initially to sort of expand your repertoire, your expertise?
I don't think it's an expansion of my repertoire. I think it's definitely it's why I went came I started my restaurant, for sure. And it's always labor has always been part of my life, like thinking about fair labor, fair compensation for one's labor, for sure. I don't think that's like separate or an adjunct or something I add on to it. It's like it's baked into my business ethos, When I began thinking about how I would structure the restaurant, I was like, what you do is you would say, okay, these are your food costs and this is your labor costs. And from there, you're going to try to figure out what you would charge for a certain dish. And I said, sometimes you do that, or you do like you kind of reverse engineer, like, oh, this is the market rate for X amount of dish. And then you go from there, like, okay, well, you're going to charge X amount. Like, you're going to charge $4 for a banh mi. And then, okay, well, here's your food cost and here's your rent. And oh, damn, there's no money for labor. And then you start to realize, oh, you carve away at all like the, what are considered like fixed costs. Even if you carve down your ingredients to the bare, like the cheapest you can get, there's like a floor, right?
Sure.
But I think the thing that people, and so, your rent is your rent. But so like what's left is your labor, and somehow that labor, there's no floor. Like, I can just squeeze,
How does that really work? I mean, you say there's no floor. Is there really no floor? Are there people making?
Yeah, because there's no floor because there's, that LA is the capital of wage theft.
I know that we have a big problem with it.
We are the number one offender.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So if your rent is your rent, your food cost is your food cost. What's the thing that fluctuates and is variable and that people can think they can carve out or like carve away? Mm-hmm. It's how much you pay your workers.
How do people do that?
People do that because consumers don't care.
Truly, how do they? Do they have people that they're just not paying, but the people show up for work anyway, or what's the?
Well, you have labor that's desperate, and the thing is that I know that wage theft happens across a spectrum. You have from your mom and pop to the restaurants that have been featured in LA Weekly, LA Times, LA Magazine, where if they have a new cook, they'll come in and they're like, okay, we're going to pay you this much an hour. And if you work overtime, you're not going to get paid overtime. And this is what it is. And you need to make sure that your mise is properly set up in this amount of time. And if it isn't, come in early and get that done. Like somehow that's part of like you prove your worth to that restaurant by working, not clocking in. And that's expected, and I know that because I have cooks who come from those places,
right.
And they're like, oh, what's this deal? I'm like, well, that's your overtime. I've never gotten overtime. Or they'll, you know, they'll get their first paycheck from these restaurants, and they know they worked more hours, right. And they just like in 2 weeks you accrue 80 hours.
Okay,
so they'll get 88 hours, mm-hmm. let's say, or 82 hours, and it's not like 80 hours at, you know, your regular wage, and then 2 hours at overtime. There's no overtime line, and they know that, and they look at whoever's giving out their paycheck,
right?
And then the manager would be like, and that's it. And that's like somehow, like, you know the drill. Like, you, this is what it means to be in the restaurant industry.
I think it's so interesting that lie still persists in some industries, that you should provide free labor, and that somehow is a sign of dedication, as opposed to maybe it being a sign of you not having any obligations outside of work or something like that.
Yeah, because it's so endemic.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, well, that's what happened. You know, that was the policy in the other restaurants that these now owners.
Mm-hmm.
have worked. And it's like, well, it doesn't mean it's right. And right. also I feel like, you know, there are, you know, the more closely you are aligned with dominant culture, the more you can transcend those barriers. And like, so, you know, like, yeah, I worked shit hours, and can we cuss?
Yes,
okay,
please.
Because I, not that I want to, I just don't. Yeah, you know, like, we're on a radio station,
right?
Like, you know, like, I work shit hours, and I made it, and now I'm like this great chef. And I go, yeah, but were you middle class to begin with?
Yeah.
Were you like a, you know, like, just, were you a dude to begin with? You know, it's not to say that, you know, your gender identity, your race, or whatever is your destiny, but it creates barriers if you don't. You're not like
yeah.
a cisgender straight white guy, you
right.
know, like, that's the truth, you know. I'm like a Vietnamese dyke, and you know, it's like, I'm like, you know, like, I don't feel like confined by that identity, but I know that, you know, there are certain access I don't have,
right,
and a certain access that I do have, you know, as mm-hmm. a cisgender woman,
sure,
you know. So yeah, so when I feel like people say, oh, well, I paid my dues, yeah, whatever. You know, like, and if you did, I feel like if you did and you really were like, you know, like, working class, just had a lot of struggles, then if you made it, then you should have compassion.
Yeah.
If you made it out, you
Isn't
know?
Isn't that very interesting how people forget that part of it?
Yeah, because I think it's like, I had a proof, like, it's like a hazing. I was hazed, so
yeah.
I'm going to haze you. And
that's
like,
right.
I'm not into it, you know?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and... yeah, that probably makes me a terrible business person, you know, like.
Well, I don't know. A restaurant that's been around for 8 years, isn't it? Don't you guys get to define success at 3 years?
Survival. Yeah, sure. You know, like, again, like, yeah, I definitely am a better cook than I'm a businesswoman.
Okay.
For sure.
Well, that happens a lot, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not that smart.
Well, I'm not
I'm not business savvy.
You can't be all things all the time. None of us can be.
I'm not.
Women try to be all the time and then feel disappointed in ourselves, but it's simply impossible. But just out of my own curiosity, when a publication runs a story about a restaurant that within the restaurant industry is known to be scammy or ripping people off or secretly using inferior product, does that happen ever, first of all? Because you mentioned knowing about new chefs at restaurants. And...
well, I mean, but it's seriously, it's like 90%, you know? Like,
really?
It's not even like... because I'm not going to go on the record for who, but I'm like, yeah, you. Yeah. Like, just the people that populate a top 10 list, you know,
mm-hmm.
for sure. You know, so I don't really like singling out one restaurant, because it's not it's like, just like, I feel like I try to bake into my business model fair wages.
Mm-hmm.
The industry in general, low wages and unfair wages are baked into that model. So, you know, it's not that I don't get mad, you know. I told this to Evan, like, you know, in the stages of grief, I never get too sad, you know.
Yeah.
I just get mad and stay mad forever,
uh-huh.
you know. So it's just like, so I get mad, or then I get depressed. You know, like, oh, this
yeah.
is so shitty. Like, this is what gets rewarded, and, you know, and that's like... if that's the, you know, the metric for success, fuck it, you know.
Right.
I don't care to be that successful.
Yeah. You
know?
Right.
I would not like to be indigent, but, you know, not at that cost. Yeah. You know, why do it, you know? So.
Well, I think that's really admirable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I'm not the only one either, you know. It's not to say that there aren't ethical business practices, but I think they're pretty rare.
That's a real bummer.
Yeah. But I also think that could change. You know, that's just like the excuses, oh, this is how it's always been run. What, you know, a lot of things change in one's lifetime, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, my grandparents, like, they saw the invention of the fucking light bulb, you know? So, you know, right? I mean, look at the, like, you know, like, I don't think technology has changed, like it hasn't created that kind of, like, you know, systemic change, like the light bulb or electricity, mm-hmm. with my grandparents. But, you know, like the change in technology, definitely in our lifetime, you know, has, like, we couldn't have imagined,
I know.
When we were five, what we'd be living like today. So,
absolutely.
So, yeah. So I think like things are nothing static, even if they, mm-hmm. they appear to be static. So.
Speaking of eras going through rapid change,
mm-hmm.
let's talk
my
about
my favorite era. What?
Yes, the Victorian era.
I love Victorian England.
Really?
Well, my idea of it.
Yeah. Tell me what your idea of it is.
Well, you know, I was a foster kid, and one of my one of the social workers came and gave, you know, they do these site visits where the last year you're happy,
mm-hmm.
where you live. And it just felt like the police.
Did you feel like you were in trouble?
Yeah, interrogated. Yeah, like, mm-hmm. you had, like, it didn't feel like, oh, we're here for your welfare. They were like, oh, don't act out.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, so at the end of the visits, they'd give us a gift of some sort. And before then, the social workers gave us, like, doodling books or something. Mm-hmm. But one particular social worker... And I think we only got one visit from her, which tells me a lot about this one. Because it's a revolving door. She gave us books. And one of the books was The Secret Garden. I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I'm just like... I had to do chores, and I remember, like, very Harry Potter, hiding under the cupboard, in the cupboard. Aww. Under the stairs, reading, and just my grandma go, where the hell is that, Dave? And I was, like, reading my Secret Garden with a flashlight and stuff. So, yeah, I'm like, oh, take me to a faraway land. You know, like, anything that's, like, not here, you know? So I love the escapism, and I've always loved language, but I think if I had a pinpoint when I loved that particular era,
mm-hmm.
you know, the cadence of the sentences. Just,
yeah.
Like, I just fell in love with that.
I was a little princess girl myself. That was the one I liked.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I didn't like it as much, I have to say.
Yeah, I don't think anyone likes them equally. I think it's one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't also identify with the princess, you know?
We're both revealing a lot about ourselves.
I mean, I'm also a Scorpio. So the idea of secrets, yes.
Oh,
you
know, I like see. I'm a Taurus, which means I like the material pleasures,
yes,
right?
Yes, you do. You like, yes. So prince, like very terrestrial.
Yeah.
Yes.
All the earthly, mm-hmm. tangible things. Mm-hmm. Gimme, gimme, gimme. Mm-hmm. So I think actually right now in the world we're currently living in, it's an interesting time to learn about Victorian food because there are a lot of assumptions that I think are being questioned right now that when we look at Victorian food, we can question similar assumptions we make about that era. For instance, right now, I feel like we're going through this change where fat was demonized for the past 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm,
and we're coming around kind of quickly, it seems to me, to this thing where it's like, oh, wait a minute. Wait, it's sugar that's bad. Oops.
Right.
We messed that up. And there's a lot that when we're children and we learn about the Victorian era, we learn that things like the railroads and refrigeration and canning all improved the way that Victorian British people ate. But that might not actually be true.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of adulteration.
Yes.
You know, that occurred, and it's because it's not, it was unregulated. Everything was moving so fast, you know.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah, like, you know, like the I mean, really, the start of it was like the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. you know, and then it proceeded from there. But yeah, like they just couldn't keep up with like the growth in cities. So they would put chalk in the flower to extend the flower. Yeah, it was pretty jacked up. Like, you know, like obviously my version that I love is very middle class, if not landed gentry, you know, like, yeah, like I remember, especially in high school, I dreamt about, if I could live in Victorian England or Canadian Edwardian Prince Edward Island era, I would be happy, you know. And then I realized, oh damn, like, okay, I'm Vietnamese, I would have probably been like a sex slave. Aww. Or something, you know, I would have been trafficked in a different way, or I'd be in the kitchen, you know. So like when I realized my identity not so good, maybe right. being a rich white lady, great in that era.
It's never not been a good thing.
Yeah, so you know, so when I kind of had that, you know, realization late, you know, in my high school days or early college days, it kind of tempered my love of Victorian, okay. you know, mm-hmm. but I still love it.
It's, are there like specific foods from that era that you particularly enjoy, have recreated for yourselves, or like the idea of perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, definitely Anne of Green Gables and Babette's Feast definitely mm-hmm. played a big role in like embedding into my brain like what kind of Edwardian Victorian foods I like, you know, like the teas, I liked the romantic friendships between women. And before I came out, it was just like this, like I just didn't want any guys around. Uh-huh. And so like the way that the society was you know, they quarantined the men from the women in a particular way, you know, like in Victorian England, like you would have sex, you know, for procreation, you uh-huh. know, and you know, like that was how, you know, it wasn't, I felt like love between men and women weren't depicted as richly as the relationships and love between women. You know, so for me as a like a latent uh-huh. dyke, you know, like, yeah, I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna live in, you know, in Victorian romantic friendships.
And I mean, I love
it. It was allowed,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. This is so interesting for me to hear because I read those same books and definitely interpreted them very differently than you did, which is fantastic. But I do, like, even me could tell that the love between women and Anne of Green Gables was, I mean, that was the whole thing.
So much deeper.
Yeah.
You know? Like, Gilbert was kind of and I love Gilbert Blythe, you know?
Yeah. And, but he was like a distraction or something.
Yeah. And I was really sad when Jonathan Crumbie died. Like,
yeah.
It was heartbreaking.
Did they eat any pot pies in Anne of Green Gables?
No, I don't. They ate the cakes.
Cakes.
Yes. Cakes. They drank a lot of cordial.
So ladylike. I ask about the pot pies because there's a dish in the feast of Babette's Feast. Mm-hmm. Now, that isn't part of the, it's not set in the Commonwealth. It's set in Denmark.
Yeah.
And it features really a French woman and French cooking.
And they depicted like France was the exotic foreign.
Right.
You know, and the evil foreigner, you know, like the almost like the heathen. I mean, it was like what she was doing was considered heathen in relationship to the religious sect.
Mm hmm. Yeah, you know, French woman who comes over with all of her, again, earthy ways.
Yes. She's definitely Taurian.
For sure.
She's definitely Taurian. And that sect is definitely Scorpio because they are so secretive.
I like it. Well, one of the dishes that's featured in the feast isn't called a pot pie.
And is it the caille en sacrifice, the little puff pastry?
Yeah, with the quail in it,
which
just looks so upsetting. And I understand that food in different eras.
That's so funny. You find it upsetting. I loved it. I was like, that looks fucking awesome.
For those of you who haven't seen it, it's a tiny bird because it's a quail, and it's in like a... It seems like it's a little bit bigger than what we think of as a ramekin, like, and then there's puff pastry.
Yeah, but there's no ramekin. She bakes. It's almost like a, what's the hell, that vol-au-vent.
Oh, I'm
it's a vol-au-vent.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And then she she par-bakes it, which I don't know how you par-bake puff paste. Like, I felt like some, like the technicality, like, how do you make that? Because that would get soggy. But anyway, so you would make right. the vol-au-vent, then you put the quail in, and you bake it again.
Just a whole-ass quail, though.
Yeah, yeah. But because it's so tiny. Well, you know, I grew up eating, you know, like at weddings, like whole quail, you know.
I think it was because when we are served whole birds, they're positioned in a certain way. But the way that the tiny bird in the puff pastry is positioned, at least in the movie, when you see it, it's on its back with its legs up.
And crossed.
Yes, and crossed so also. It was really cute. Okay.
Wow. Well, you know, you're mirroring the religious sect.
Yes.
The sisters who were like.
Yeah.
Like
it's
when,
too much.
When was it the general that like sucked out the brains out from
because
the head?
He was the other French person there who could tell them how wonderful it was. And they didn't because no one else understood and he had to explain to them.
He wasn't French though.
Wasn't he?
His auntie, he's Danish. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he.
It's been a minute.
He was war. Fucking my Bible, girl. Yeah. Like he was worldly.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah. All right. He knew about wine.
Yeah, and he had been to France and
been
had eaten
to France.
At
all right. Yeah,
this place.
He'd eaten at the. Well, we don't want to give it all away. Anyway,
spoiler from the 80s.
Yeah, I know. Even earlier, because it was a short story by Isaac Dennison at some point. I just wondered because that was like a specific movie that you referenced, and now you are perhaps known. I get scared saying this sort of thing to people because you never know how people see themselves versus other people. But a lot of people know about your pies.
Yes.
Your pot pies?
I do love pot pies.
Okay. Do you feel comfortable hearing that, like, people know that most from your repertoire?
I don't. I don't really, you know, I'm not going to micromanage what you think of me. I don't mind it. I mean, I loved it, you know, but it's actually not Babette's Feast that made me think of the pot pie.
Yeah?
Or made me think of putting a pot pie in the menu. It's actually Swanson's frozen pot pies.
Oh my God, look at this high-low culture all in one
person.
I mean,
I loved it, you know, when I was a kid. Like, I was definitely intrigued by the exotica that is Americana, you know?
Great. Like, yeah.
It's just like, you know, just that my grandparents definitely bought Swanson's pot pie because it was very affordable.
Okay.
But I remember growing up when they had commercials for Hungry Man. And it was like this lumberjack. Like, you didn't even see his freaking face. Like, he was like, Hungry Man. And then he would come and he would like drop his like toolbox or bag or whatever, and you just see his lumberjack feet and hungry, you know.
Yeah.
And I just like, and then they would just this beauty shot of like the Salisbury steak, let's say.
Right. Gorgeous.
You know, and I was just so intrigued, and I go, oh, I want the Hungry Man so bad, you know. And but my grandma's like, oh, that's too expensive. Like, and it was like, we have food, you don't need it felt like a luxury, you know, and she wasn't really like, she really sold on the, like, that it would be good. Like, she was a magnificent cook, so number one. It was Hungry Man and the Manwich. Like, I wanted a Manwich so bad. Like, which it's very weird because they're both like male, like Hungry Man and Manwich. Like,
yeah.
It was my butch side that responded to that, the commercials, but like, I remember, and my brothers, I remember one time, he would say, like, yeah, grandma was, like, she was so cheap, you know, like, she was just, like, she just was very good at just budgeting, and, you know, like, he would just say, like, yeah, I remember when grandma used to make us beg, like, bitches for $20, you know, like, it's true. She made us beg like bitches, you know, like, just, I remember begging like a bitch for sure for that Hungry Man and Manwich, and I never got it.
Those weren't allowed, but Swanson's pot pies were.
Yeah, because they were cheaper.
Okay.
You know, and they were kind of more considered snacks versus.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, because they were tiny.
Okay.
You know, like, it was like in between, you know, like after school kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, a Hungry Man just looked like dinner.
Meant to be a whole meal.
Yeah. But I did buy a Hungry Man dinner and a man which can in college.
Yeah.
It did not live up. Like, this is it. Yeah.
That's sometimes the downside of effective marketing.
Yeah. But but I'm glad I did it, you know. I'm glad I bought it. But yeah, it loomed like this great, you know, great thing I couldn't attain.
Well, a lot of these easy dinners, easy cooking, you could trace the root of it to the Victorian era. The Industrial Revolution made it happen, but then living in the post-Industrial Revolution, canned food wasn't widely commercially available until the 1860s. By the 1870s, can openers were considered a kitchen tool staple.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's such a dumb little thing, but when you really think about it, that's amazing. People change the objects that they bought for their home because of a food invention.
Yeah, and that food invention actually started as a military invention.
Yep.
You know, so, like, I think...
The whole military industrial complex right here in your little, like, can of sardines.
Yeah, like, economic power and military power, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting.
And
then there's the refrigeration. Why, like, refrigerated trains, especially?
Yes, yes. So, I, you know, like, that, remember what scene in, it's not my favorite version of Little Women, but the Winona Ryder and Gabriel Byrne, was that his name?
Yeah, it is Gabriel Byrne. I always get him confused with the other, with David Byrne, but this one is Gabriel Byrne.
Right?
Yeah. I think my internet doesn't work in here. Oh, side note, we're in the KPCC studios today because we're... So fancy.
So fancy. I love it. I love it. It's AC'd. You know, there's that moment where she's like, she's left the house. She's in some sort of like boarding home. And she's like wanting to be a serious writer. Because you can tell because her fingers are all inked up.
Yeah. Which a lady would never do.
So she's fiercely writing in her writing cap. It's cold and she has fingerless gloves. I love
so many accessories.
I love this shit so much. Yeah. and then she you know, she hears a knock on the door and she opens and she looks down and it's like there's a Mandarin Orange, you know, and and I love that scene. I thought that was they just captured it so well. Like that was such a luxurious thing to get something from the tropics and so. And then she's like, it looked like the fucking best Mandarin orange.
I know, it would have been or in that era.
Tangerine, Mandarin? I don't know. It looked easy to peel, so I feel it's
right,
a Mandarin.
Right. Well, so one thing that I didn't realize is that when we're talking about Victorian food and things like fruit and vegetables that are not root vegetables, I didn't know that people had cherries available to them in England. And I guess,
I didn't know that either. Yeah, I thought it was just candied.
Right. No, like fresh cherries were a staple fruit throughout the summer.
Mm.
In the winter, it was apples, which is less exciting. But the fruit that was available to people in England before they started packaging up all the food was actually quite healthy and more varied. There's lots of jokes about how, you know, potatoes, obviously, other root vegetables, bread, and beer.
Right.
The beer was basically just water. It was like 1-2% alcohol.
Yeah, I think it's also a way to, you know, have safe water too.
Right. I mean, that's what it came from. But it is interesting now to know that people could, in fact, be drinking water literally constantly all day and not getting drunk.
Right.
Once.
Right. Yeah. Well, because also the temperance movement started to grow in that era too. So
that must have gone well. So that was about gin.
Yes.
But then
became
teetotaler.
Which just goes to show
that, that like beer was less of a concern, and then people started getting way too lit on gin on the other side of things, and then the temperance movement had to start to counteract that because everything is always on a pendulum.
Right.
I read this really interesting paper. I read it on the National Institutes of Health site, but it's from the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. And I'll put it up on the site when we air this episode. And it talked about things like height and how we think of how that we're on some sort of constant progress up in terms of people getting taller and deciding that that's because we're becoming more healthful. Not so. The British Army in 1900 had to reduce their height requirement for soldiers because people were getting so much shorter.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It had always been 5 foot
like,
six. Because
scurvy and stuff.
Yes, because of dang scurvy. They moved it from 5 foot.
Scurvy is not funny.
I know, but yes. You're allowed to laugh. To 5 foot three.
Wow.
So they had to reduce it by 3 inches because people were simply not growing as tall after the advent of a quote unquote varied diet. And the variation came from packaged foods.
Wow.
Yeah. There's also cultural ways that we approach salt. Now we sprinkle salt on a dish, on food, when we have it on a plate. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find where exactly it changed, but prior to that, people would actually put a spoonful of salt on their plate in its own little pile and sort of like dip items as they go.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Which the idea was that they would do it less frequently. It's kind of like that weird thing from the 80s of putting your salad dressing on the side and putting the fork tines in the salad dressing and then in the greens.
I wonder also what kind of salt it is. Probably not, you know, it's probably coarser, you know, so it won't be as salty if you dipped.
Yeah,
you know,
right? Yeah, it's not you're not immersing.
Like table salt
we
know today.
That's probably
that
right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. I had not known that. See, I'm going to log it into my brain.
It's definitely going in your files. I feel like you definitely have a filing cabinet in your brain.
I love it. It's like an accordion file. It can accommodate so much.
Oh, yeah. Lucky. I wish I had that.
Just for joy and shit, though. Just for that. I swear it's like not very useful. It's just,
I don't know. I feel like it influences your work.
It definitely does, for sure.
Yeah. Definitely. By 19... okay. So the whole thing about British people having bad teeth, that also was not always so. That happened in the second half of the 1800s when they got more candied fruits. So a lot of the fruits that were brought in from the Commonwealth were candied. People would eat them. Their tooths were rotting out. This piece says that by 1900, it was commonly noted that people could no longer chew tough foods.
Wow.
So it was a thing primary sources were commenting on. So that means that it was a change that was taking place that was noteworthy.
Wow. I did not know that either.
I know. Crazy. Now, the main thing, I think...
But I feel like maybe the rotting teeth is also... Was it more prevalent in, like... Because sugar wasn't that cheap. It only became cheap, like, late Victorian.
Well, that is true, but I think...
When they conquered more.
Right. But they were doing things as early as they could, like condensed milk. And again, the idea of condensed milk was so that poor people wouldn't starve. But condensed milk has added sugar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think
the Vietnamese people also love the
condensed
milk.
Yeah, that is true.
We love it. So
I mean, it's good. A lot of people like it. Oh, and the canned fruits were in syrup. They were canned in syrup. So I would imagine, this is me just spitballing here, that bad teeth maybe wasn't so much a concern, so that when they were creating these sugary products, maybe they hadn't thought about the downside in terms of teeth.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like, you know, as England became more prosperous, the teeth got worse because you could afford more sugar to all the classes, not just...
That totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
For sure.
Like, you know, developed countries and obesity rates.
So. That's right. Yeah, they were talking in this piece about how many calories people ate.
Because I do think it was like... I don't think the landed gentry ate a lot of calories compared to, or did they? Like, what kind of calories? You know, because I feel like you
so
ate
poor
a
people
lot
definitely
of,
eat nutrient
like,
dense calories,
yes, right?
Yes,
like a lot
for
of starches
sure.
mm-hmm. and carbs.
Yeah, meat know? Only when they could, but
because they didn't have an oven.
Yeah,
they would have to, you know, like
use the town oven.
Yeah, like in A Christmas Tale.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
a Christmas
exactly.
Carol.
But one thing that like blew my mind, hadn't even thought of or hadn't put the dots together. So for upper class women, the clothes they wore, that's like a body weight workout all the time. They're wearing literally pounds of clothing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason that they had kind of a hard time.
And they were literally wearing whalebone.
Yeah.
You know?
Bones of whale on their person. But that's kind of like, you know how when you work out and you put like a weight on your abs when you're doing sit-ups or on your back when you're doing push-ups? That was what they were living Right. That was their life.
Well, hence the fainting couch. And
yeah,
all that,
you know. That's right. So everything was a workout and people were eating regularly up to 5,000 calories a day.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can see that a baker doing that. I can see a baker. I can see people who just like working night and day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not consider that for the ladies that. And the brocade.
Well, they were probably eating less. It's always been a thing to have women eat less than men.
Sure.
That's something we could go on forever, mm-hmm. but let's just take that as fact.
Right.
But for working people, for sure, eating up to that many calories, but burning that many calories.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
in the course of a day.
I mean, the idea of 8 hours of work a day was that was a union mm-hmm. win. That mm-hmm. like you just like yeah crack a dawn yeah you gotta do it until you know it's no longer any light
yeah.
for use that you can use to work
yeah, yeah just constant movement. And when you think about all the appliances that they didn't have
yeah I love this show called Supersizers.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
It's a fucking the best show ever and I just like binge watch this on YouTube and it's God fucking it. Sorry, guy. His name is Giles something.
Okay.
And Sue Perkins. Sue Perkins. Chandler was super. So they have this show where the two of them, they eat for a whole week, one era in British culinary culture, you know? Or, yeah. So they went all the way from, like, Roman times to, like, the 80s or whatever. And they did this whole thing on... my favorite was the Restoration, which is crazy, just crazy. And then they did a whole Victorian thing where uh-huh. it's just, you're just like, wow, that's like a lot of gross shit. Like, it kind of like, it romanticizes, like, it looks at what you romanticize and say, actually, they were pretty unhealthy. They, you know, yeah, really dirty.
Yeah.
You know, and all this clothes. And yeah, so it's if you're into like just any era, because it's not just Victorian era, you know, like it's a great series to watch. And she's hilarious, too. And they did this thing where they would have to go to the doctor for every show, every era, and they would get their blood work, and uh-huh. you know, and then they said, well, you know, you're gonna probably have your cholesterol increased because they didn't eat any vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're gonna drink like I think during Restoration, you're gonna be drunk most of the day because, like, you know, because there's no clean water, you know, so
and they have to get used to drinking beer. Yeah, all day.
So your liver's gonna be impacted. So they. You know, and it was really interesting, just like in just 1 week, how it changed their physical health.
That sounds like something that the listeners of this show would really enjoy.
Oh, you'd love it.
Yeah,
it's so and she's funny.
That's awesome.
So you can't be eating while you're watching because there's some stuff you just like your gag reflex is gonna just kick in because
oh my gosh.
It's gross. Like Restoration, like you know how one would use the toilet in Restoration.
Yeah,
I didn't want to eat.
I thought this was interesting. I learned that in 1861 this cookbook came out that was kind of quietly revolutionary because it had specific measurements. Listed in it.
Is that the Mrs. Beaton's?
It's not Mrs. Beaton's. Mm. I think that it predates her by a little bit. But and it's also not one of the like really famous ones
right.
like Mrs. Beaton's. It was just like when you look at it now, I guess the people who study cookbooks are like, oh, this one actually tells you like specifically. Not just like have a bunch of beef and a bunch of salt. It like really, which I think must speak to the fact that people before had just been learning how to cook. The people who were expected to feed themselves were just learning how to cook naturally. And now we're coming to a point with the middle class and people working out, like children not doing chores necessarily, maybe working outside the home. The art of cooking was no longer learned, passed down generation to generation, perhaps.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I get that point, but I also do think the better way is through the doing, you know?
See, this is another difference between you and me because my mom is the same way. My mom is a great cook also, and she can just throw stuff together and have it taste amazing. Mm-hmm. I have to keep looking at the book because I'll forget what's happening and I don't know numbers and I'll get all confused.
I mean, yeah, but I think a cookbook, I find cookbooks very useful, but it's not the measurements. It's just like, oh, I'm fine with this a list of ingredients because I don't think you can be a good cook just with the measurements. Like,
well, that's more like being a good scientist or, I mean, that's following orders.
Yeah, but
being a good kitchen soldier.
But it's not true because this is what I also think. Like Victorian England like felt like it was, you know, like the rise of technology or like their idea of scientific, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everything had to be like a level, you know, like somehow it's everything can be be replicated the same. Right. So if you get this cookbook, you do everything on it, you will get exactly if you put all this input, you will get the exact output. And that's not true. I think that's a fallacy because mm-hmm. you know how powerful that onion is. So the onion is a shitty onion. You're going to need four onions to equal one really great onion. So you don't, if your farmer is a shitty farmer, you know, I feel like it gives a false sense of security. That I don't think that bears out, because then you'd have all these great cooks cook like Julie Chow, but you don't, because
right. she sure don't.
Yeah, you know. So I mean, I understand. I'm just being a little contrarian, but I don't necessarily think measurements. I think the dissemination of these are the ingredients and kind of get a sense of like proportion, like I never made Kion sacrifice, and then here's a list of ingredients, and like this is you only get one teaspoon of salt versus a pound of meat. You kind of get a ratio. I think ratios are, you know, I think that they taught people who don't have really, you know, who didn't have moms that had, you know, that taught them that this gave them a sense of ratio, and then they fumble towards success or not, you know. But I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's the measurement. I mean, even like we batch brew or we do a big batch of cold brew
mm-hmm.
every 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. And we use the same counterculture coffee blend, you know. I think it's a hologram with a little bit of Apollo, right? Like, it turns out differently every time,
really?
You know. And it's like, sometimes it's us. Sometimes it's like, counterculture, like, they're beans, you know. Like, it's so the idea of, like, that's the thing I always tell my cooks, like, this is the recipe. I'm going to give you the recipe, but I really need you to taste. It's like, why did everything go? You haven't cooked. Yeah, you assembled ingredients,
yeah.
and you put it in a pot, but that's like in the end you have to taste, you know.
Yeah.
And so it, but I think you know, like starting with like cookbooks, especially in the Victorian times, like you follow these recipes and scientifically you'll create this. I think that's traveled, you know, and that's like stayed with us. But just, you know, like again, I think cookbooks are great. I can look at a cookbook. I kind of just ignore the measurements a little bit, you know. And I don't think it's about alchemy. And I can't separate myself from like being a professional at it. But even before, like when I was just with my grandmother, you know, like.
I mean, you might have had a natural aptitude for it.
I do for sure. Like, you know, I mean, you can't have been living under my grandparents' roof and not have any of that passion seep into your psyche, you know. Like my sister's a great cook, my brother's a great cook too, but he's more of a gourmand, you know. He's having like he loves eating, he enjoys it,
right?
You know, but like it's all like he has a great palate, and it's because it's my grandma was it was for her it was all about honing your palate and never about ingredients, because she, you know. And she would get very just like miffed, like, oh, just don't waste my time by measurements, don't, you know. Then you haven't got, and like, you know, she wasn't generous enough to say, that's not the point, dear. What you really want to do is hone your palate. She would just stop asking a dumbass question, you know. So, but really, you know, in the end, it's like, I always try, like, each cook, like, you know, I know when they kind of have hit a new, like, a new development, you know, a new stage in the development as a cook is when they're like, oh, I tasted it and it wasn't quite right. I think it needs this, and then it needs like they do two adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, oh yes, yeah, you know, you're like you're kind of starting to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what a good cook is. So many people are, for various reasons, just cooking to survive.
Yeah, well, which is fine. You know, I mean, yeah. Like,
I know.
You know, some days I don't. I mean, that's why cooks eat. Professional cooks eat like the junkiest food.
That's right. Yeah,
it's just so like we just don't really care. Like we spent at least 8 hours, if not 12 hours, in intentional cooking. I just want something.
Yeah.
You know. So, Jack in the Box. It is.
Jack
you know?
In the Box. Yeah. Like the most cooking at home is toasting something.
Yeah, I do love noodles. I feel like that's like my comfort. Like,
yeah.
Like don't like even if like. sometimes like I get something too fancy when I get home, you know, like it's like, oh, like can you put it in a to-go box and muss it up a little bit? Just something like, I don't know why. It's just like, I don't want it to be curated. I don't want it. And I hate like my neighbors, because I feel like when I'm in the restaurant, my like chi is everywhere, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm noticing that customer in table six that like trying to make eye contact, yeah. like, you know, like I just, so it's like I'm just like constantly aware, you know, because it's you know, I'm invested, right? So when I get home, I'm just like my wind down is when I'm driving home,
yeah.
And just like, I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm about to be in a place where with nobody except for one other person that I really like. You know? I'm actually looking forward to seeing her, you know? And then so my neighbors know to like leave me the hell alone, like to not say hi to me, you know? Because one time this neighbor, and I just like, I was so pissed. And they found out through another neighbor, like, don't say hi to Deep. Especially when it's 11 p.m. Just don't say God. Hi. The idea of having to say hi to somebody at 11 fucking p.m. enrages me so much, because I'm like, I'm done. I just have nothing left. I need to recharge. And I don't care if you're saying the most, you know, what the most wonderful thing to me. Like, I can't.
I love that you laid down the law in your neighborhood.
I mean, it's really small. Deep.
Let me tell you something about Deep.
She's a bitch. You know, I'm just like, oh, I love you. I love you. Just don't say hi to me. So they all know. They just leave me alone. Or when they see me sitting in the car, they just leave me alone.
That's really funny.
And I appreciate it. It's like, thank you.
I think that's really powerful that you have them trained.
Well, I mean, I don't train them. I just refuse to interact.
That is training. That is a form of training.
Yes. I'm like, no.
Oh man. Yeah. Speaking of which, let's talk about life expectancy.
Yeah.
Which Deep's neighbors don't have a lot of if they keep saying hi to her at night. People talk about how in olden times everyone died. There's always, you know, like, oh, well, I'm 35. I'd be a grandma by now. I'd be dead by now but okay, let's talk about the word average. That's not what that means.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
The idea that everyone was dying early because of poor nutrition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In the early part of the Victorian era, just simply isn't true. Average life expectancy means the average of when everybody died, and this includes babies,
right? So I'm talking about, you're talking about infant mortality.
Yes, what people forget about. If what scientists now do to calculate life expectancy is they start with five-year-olds. If you're still alive when you're five, they'll calculate it from then to the, you know, end of time, mm-hmm. Because it just changes, because infant mortality is something sometimes completely different, but you can't really get an average in terms of like some sort of understanding of the culture of a time if you include babies who die. So if you talk about the life expectancy of 5 years old and up in the Victorian era, they were living just as long as us.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Early 70s for the men and late 70s
for
the women.
That's why in Victorian times, they were waiting for those aunties to die to inherit those estates.
Yeah. Like, and the aunties wouldn't die.
They would not. Aunt Josephine lived for a long ass time.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to throw that out there because
I like that.
Little thing, and I know it makes me no fun, but when people are like, well, if this were 100 years ago, you'd be dead by now. Nope. No, you wouldn't. Like, you still got...
Catherine, I think you're loads fun. I love a pedantic finger in the air going, no, waving, and then readjusting your glasses.
It is kind of fun.
Well, that's why I think you would not enjoy Anne of Green Gables, because there's so many anachronistic things in there.
Can't handle
it. It's
that.
Like, respect, just respect the
I
book.
Know.
Yeah.
Movies that feature a lot of food.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a list? We've already covered the. I mean, Babette's Feast is important to you.
I love Babette's Feast. All the Renaissance. I mean, not the Renaissance. The Regency Jane Austen.
Okay.
I love my favorite Jane Austen adaptation. It's Persuasion.
That's kind of a rare choice. Yeah.
I love that. That's my favorite.
Okay.
That's my favorite. And I can't remember men's last names now. Kiernan, you know, he played Captain Wentworth.
They've all played each other.
Yes. But that production was great, because you saw them like trotting through muddy roads, and it was just, and the meats were really great. There was just like a table just of meats that they just had like a knife, and they were carving, and some flies were around, and just like bread that just tearing off, and it's still half. You know, there's like maybe like
very
a
visceral.
Third left. Yeah, it's like real, real nice. Like that's why I don't really, I didn't like the Keira Knightley one. It was like, it was too Crate and Barrel for me. You know, like it was.
Too Crate and Barrel.
Like it didn't have a sense of the time, you know, but that Persuasion was super great, you know.
In the Gwyneth Paltrow Emma, they do a lot of picnics.
Yeah, it was too clean. It was too clean. Even though I did like the inclusion of the alpine strawberries that we're picking on the side. You know, but it's, yeah, I think it's because, yeah, I even like now, like, we're not as clean as our Instagram would, you know, tell people.
Yeah, we are.
You know what I mean? Like, so the idea, like, I felt like, you know, like, Emma, Gwyneth Paltrow's Emma is kind of like an Instagram Jane Austen.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see that.
Where the production of Persuasion was like, it just felt real, and it didn't mar my enjoyment of it at all. It actually made me, like, it just, I got to sink into it a little more.
There's a lot of movies that have food scenes that are sex scenes at the same time, which in
like
real...
Like Tampopo?
Yeah, Tampopo. Ooh, that one. I remember, I don't think my parents... When I think about the movies that I saw when I was very young, I think my parents were like on another planet or something like that. That's inappropriate.
I mean, I think it aired on PBS.
Artsy sex, if there's...
No, I mean, you know what also aired on PBS that... I got in not so much trouble, but had created an awkward situation for me. It was A Room with a View. And
oh, because there's dong in that.
Yes, that lake scene.
Oh, I remember.
So I'm watching PBS on a Saturday because of a fucking nerd. You know, I'm like, after the cooking shows, I'm going to stay on, watch Mastery's Theater. You know, that was my thing. I'm like, please, if I didn't have to go work in anybody's restaurant, it's like, Mastery's Theater.
Well,
and
I
Julia
love
Child,
Room with
you
a View.
It's great.
Yeah.
So that scene, okay, so I'm watching, I'm like, oh my God. And you know, and you kind of never knew when it came on unless you had a TV guide handy or whatever. So I'm just like, oh my God, Room with a View is on. So halfway into it. And Julian Sands at the height of his powers and
so
his
fine.
Beauty, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm watching it and I forgot. I'm not that interested in dong. So I forgot the scene, you know? My grandpa walks in.
Ooh.
And they're just running around. Penis are flying. You know, they were flying.
They were
floppity flopping
for sure.
And then... He looks at me, and I'm just looking so guilty, you know? I don't know, I was like 13, 14. I'm like, ah! You know, just like just looking back and forth. And then he just walks away. And he's like, not even talking to me, just talking to himself like, she's watching porn. She's watching porn. You know, like just like... You know, like,
really
that deserved a slap. That deserved, you know, like, that deserved some sort of punishment. But he was so shocked that he just, he would rather not know what happened. You know?
Did he really think it was porn?
Yeah, it's pretty porny. You know, I mean, he didn't watch he just saw a bunch of men.
Floppers.
Like, it looked like gay porn, too. You know, I mean, it was gay porn.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And, so.
What about Joy Luck Club with the watermelon?
You know, I love Joy Luck Club at the time. I feel like it looms so large I wish there were other authors that could occupy the space. You know, like there can only be one Asian American writer. You know, like there can only be one. So I feel like I love it. And I love Amy Tan, but I just wish please dominant culture allow other women.
Right.
You know, other writers.
Right.
Like I love Monique Jung.
Okay.
The Book of Salt. I love Bitter in the Mouth, and I wish I wish they would make movies out of her books. You know.
Okay.
But yeah, I love Joy Luck Club at the time.
I just remember that that watermelon scene was. Made me very uncomfortable.
Well, again, it was Het, so I wasn't like all of my girlfriends at that was like, ah! I was like, what? You know, I was just like, okay, go have your sassy moment or whatever. Like, I just wasn't that interested, but I definitely liked more. I love Tampopo. I love the perverse live prawn scene, you know, and the weird. I didn't love, but I was very disturbed by the oyster scene. But I love Eat, Drink, Marry, Woman. I thought that was, I love that a lot. I mean,
yeah.
And, but my, I think my favorite Asian, it had to be Asian, not Asian, Asian American, Asian food scene is, okay, this, the background music is Perhaps, Perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fucking Maggie Cheung going in the fucking rain with a tiffin tin to get some fucking noodles, you know, like, yes, you know, like
all your favorite things.
I know. Thank you. I didn't think of that. Noodles like that in the rain.
Yeah.
You know, and then going back to mahjong. You know, yeah. I think that was much. If that was sexier, I felt, than the watermelon, which is like, you know.
Well, the watermelon thing, I don't even know if it was like sexy.
I mean, it's supposed to be. Oh, no, there was a lot of wet panties, you know. You know. I mean, I went to see it with a bunch of Asian American women. We were like, you know, like,
yeah.
They were definitely, it was giving them life for sure.
Okay.
You know.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Victorian food and lots of stuff. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I had a great time. And you can correct me on any Victorian arcana you wish. I would love it.
It's
I would
fun.
Appreciate it.
Well, maybe people could. Are you on Twitter?
I am.
What's your Twitter
handle? Goodgirl.net.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tweet at Goodgirl.net and tell her some facts.
I'd love it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey everybody, Catherine Spires back to catch you one quick moment before you go. Here's how to get in touch with Smart Mouth. You can find us on Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast. We're also on Facebook at Smart Mouth Podcast and on Twitter at Smart Mouth Pod. Thanks for listening, everybody.